This is Bill Alder for the State Historical Society, seated here with Mr. Fred Trenk. And we're going to discuss this afternoon the various aspects of natural resource history that Mr. Trenk has been interested and instrumental in accomplishing here in Wisconsin. First of all, I'm going to ask Mr. Trenk to give us a little biographical sketch of himself, and then we'll launch into a topic-by-topic discussion of the forestry work that he has been doing for the last 30, 40 years or so. So, Mr. Trenk, you just take her away now and...
I'll be glad to, Mr. Oliver. I was born in Dubuque, Iowa in 1900, but while still a youngster, a few months old, my folks moved to a farm on the bluffs above the Mississippi, directly across from Dubuque. And as a youngster, it was always a great thrill to me to watch the steamboats going up and down the river, and particularly to watch the log rafts coming down. And I think I can correctly say that I watched the last log raft that ever came down the Mississippi River, at least as far as Dubuque. The Standard Lumber Company had its largest sawmill at Dubuque, and that was the last sawmill on the Mississippi River in 1911, when the Standard Lumber Company burned to the ground. We watched the fire from our farm home on the bluffs during the night. It was one of the most spectacular things one could ever have watched, and might be interested to know that the famous shock tower, which at that time was a lookout tower right in the lumberyard grounds, was on fire. And literally it was an enormous Roman candle. We watched it 4 miles away, and we could see clearly that the shot tower was burning up. Well, that was the last that my young sister and I had ever had an opportunity to see the log rafts go down, because that was the last mill. Later on, about high school age, we moved back to the city of Dubuque. I took forestry training at Iowa State College, and after finishing my work at Iowa State, I was employed by the University of Maryland as extension forester. I spent nearly 7 years in that position, and on January 1st, 1931, Professor Hatch brought me to Wisconsin as the extension forester here at the University of Wisconsin. It certainly has been an interesting 30 years that I've been here. Wisconsin was just on the threshold of some of the most outstanding legislative achievements and administrative achievements in forestry that I think any state has experienced. It pioneered in the forest crop law, it pioneered in the rural zoning law, it pioneered in some shelter belt planting and mechanical tree planting and community and school forests. Many of those things took part in their initial stages immediately early in the 1930s. And since then, it has been really interesting to see the developments.
Well, now you mentioned the shelter belt project that the state of Wisconsin undertook. I wonder if you could give us some of the history of that particular project.
There is a bit of history back of that project, because it begins at a time when dust storms were of considerable importance throughout the western half of the United States, and that included Wisconsin. I'm sure many have heard of the terms the Okies and the Arkies. They were the people from Oklahoma and Arkansas that were literally blasted by winds out of their homes and had to move elsewhere. Well, Wisconsin got the backlash of some of those terrific dust storms in 1934. But we didn't come in on the governmental aids that those western states got. You may remember that in 1934, after those great storms, President Roosevelt had Congress enact legislation that set up the National Western Shelter Belt Project, and the government poured millions and millions of dollars into it. Now, that same year, 1934, Wisconsin set up its own Shelter Belt Project, but it did not have any federal aids. I think it might be interesting to name some of the people who were key figures in setting up a 10-year Shelter Belt Project, which has really made some marked impacts on the landscape of central Wisconsin. In September of 1934, in the little village of Almond, there was a committee meeting that was attended by K.L. Hatch, Director of Extension, Mr. Harley McKenzie, Director of the Conservation Department, Chris Christensen, Dean of the College of Agriculture, and the County Agricultural Committees and the County Agricultural Agents from Central Counties, Washera, Portage, Wapaka, nearby, and of course my office, the Extension Forestry Office, was represented. This group drew up what you might call a Shelter Belt Compact, if we want to give it that term. In it, the Conservation Department committed itself to furnish an unlimited number of trees for a 10-year period for planting on sandy soil in central Wisconsin, provided these trees would be planted in shelter belts, that is, in rows, three or four rows wide across the open stretches of farmland, and that these trees would be distributed under the supervision of the Extension Service, which also would be responsible for seeing that they were properly cared for. And so in the winter of 1934-35, we began holding meetings in almost every crossroads of the central sandy area, taking orders for free shelter belt trees. The spring of 35 saw about 300,000 or 400,000 planted. That was rather small compared to what we ultimately were able to plant, but it took some time to sell the idea. Now, I might review briefly the services that the Conservation Department gave in addition to furnishing trees. They furnished trucks to truck the trees to what we called depots or distribution centers. There were five or six of these distribution centers in every one of those counties. Farmers who had ordered trees were notified of the exact hour and day and place that their trees would be ready for distribution. Farmers came for them. And in addition to handing out the trees, at every one of these distribution centers we conducted a demonstration in the proper method of setting trees, how to keep the roots moist, how to tamp the soil, and discussion of what kind of cultivation was needed later. And this took, of course, a great deal of time. Over that 10-year period, we repeated this annually. And when you consider that at the end of the 10-year period, there were something like 3,000 miles of shelter belts planted by farmers in those seven central counties without any federal aid or supplementary payment, we consider that we did a great event. Now, I can point out one rather thrilling experience I had a few years ago. I was flying in a north central plane to Warsaw. There was about 6 inches of snow on the ground. After we had flown north from the Columbia County line, these shelter belts began to show up, as they would, with just that little snow on the ground. And by the time we were over Washera County, as far as one could see, both east and west, you could spot those shelter belts quarter mile after quarter mile and running in their north-south direction generally. I got a tremendous thrill out of that.
I'll bet you did. Yeah. Now, naturally, in any new program, there are bound to be a few or many objections. Could you recite some of the arguments that were presented as to why this particular program shouldn't be carried out?
We didn't have too much objection. I will say we had one advantage to start with. My predecessor, Mr. Fred Wilson, back in the late 20s, had established a few demonstrations, well distributed geographically, on these sandy soils to show what a shelter belt might do. And they, in that 7 or 8 year period, had reached a size that they did prove their effectiveness in those dust storms. So we had a real demonstration to fall back on, and that was very helpful. Although there were those who were reluctant at first to, say, give up that much land to plant trees, and they were afraid, too, that As the old saying goes, the trees would sap the soil. You wouldn't be able to farm anywhere near the trees. The reason, I think, for their misconception of sapping soil, as they said, was the belts of oak trees, native oak that was growing in that area. It's well known that oak does take a great deal of moisture and fertility out of the soil, and sometimes for 30, 40, 50 feet from the edge of a oak shelter belt, there won't be much agricultural development. There'll be very poor crops. But we were able to demonstrate under some of these older shelter belts that they were able to grow very good alfalfa and potatoes right up to the tips of the pine limbs. And when they saw that it was that good, and when they also saw that during the winter time the snow lay on the fields that had been protected by these belts, when otherwise without them the snow would have blown away in that open area, they realized more moisture was being trapped and going into the soil, and so the work went on very fine. Now, one thing I think we should say, that at the end of 1945, when the free granting of trees ended, and people from then on had to pay, there was a very little drop in the number of trees ordered. And 2 years later, they were ordering more than they ever had before, even though we had gone through a war period and there had been severe shortages in labor. To me, the fact that farmers during that war period felt it was as vital as anything to get out and plant shelter belt trees was a great testimony to their conviction that it was a smart thing to do.
I see. Did the improvement in tree planting equipment have any particular effect on the shelter belt movement here in the state of Wisconsin?
No, it didn't. 90% or more of all the trees that went into the shelter belts were hand planted.
They were hand planted.
This was before we had mechanized tree planting, and it was all hard work.
That's a backbreaking job, all right.
Well, it is on some soil. Fortunately, on sand, it isn't
quite
as rough.
On sand, it isn't too bad, no.
That's right.
What has the university extension done in as far as mechanizing the tree planting operations now?
Well, that's a second phase of work that has been expanded considerably in recent years, and I'm very happy to say that the University of Wisconsin, primarily the Agricultural Engineering Department, had a key position in laying the groundwork for the mechanization of tree planting. In 1943-44, we were facing some surplus tree problems at the nursery because of a shortage of manpower. And we knew that it would just be too bad to plow under those trees. And I had often felt that there must be a better way, even in those shelter belt sandy soils, of putting in trees than the way the Pharaohs might have done it. So with the help of Professor Brune of the Ag Engineering Department and with the encouragement of Professor Duffy, Mr. Brune and I set to work on some basic designs whereby we might mechanize tree planting. This moved along very well to the point where we felt we had a workable machine. Now, I might say, and this is an interesting footnote, in 1943, trying to buy farm machinery was a major enterprise, even secondhand. We had agreed on a tree planting machine that would use the tractor trailer plow. I think farmers know what we're talking about there, one of these one or two bottom plows that was pulled behind a tractor and had a gear hoist. But I spent the better part of 2 weeks going to secondhand dealers in southern Wisconsin, even trying to find those kind of plows during the war, but we wound up with 13 of them. The Conservation Department agreed, and here was fine help from the department, agreed that it would build these machines at its Forest Protection headquarters at Tomahawk, where they had heavy machinery to work with. And in turn, the machines were to be offered principally to the counties to be used as custom planting machines in central Wisconsin. Well, that spring, actually, we had 15 machines. The spring of 44, we had 15 machines in operation, and we had no surplus tree plow. Because one machine with two men would plant in one day what it would ordinarily take a farmer's son a week or 10 days to plant. So you see that that really
that was
cut
quite
down.
A machine.
It is interesting to note, too, that we publicized our first formal demonstration of mechanical tree planting quite widely in May of 1944. Our main unveiling, shall we say, was held in Wood County on some Wood County property, and we invited foresters from other states to see Wisconsin's venture into this. There were foresters from Indiana and Illinois and Michigan who came, and they studied what we had done. We realized, of course, that this was only preliminary. Certainly there would be improvements, and these men saw where they could improve on it. But there are now four principal types of tree planting machines on the market in the United States. There are thousands of machines that have been built by one or the other of these four designs, and every one of them traces to visits made by those visiting foresters studying our Wisconsin design. I don't accuse any of them of stealing ideas. They improved on ours, but we had demonstrated what had not been demonstrated before, that you could use certain principles in mechanical tree planting that would work even on wild, unplowed lands. There was one planting machine on the market in the 40s, but it was limited to use on land that was completely tilled, like you were ready to plant tobacco. And of course, we were working on many lands that were far from so well tilled. So there's quite a history back of the development of mechanical tree planting right here in Wisconsin. One Wisconsin company took over the basic Wisconsin design. Then others have used the designs that these other foresters had worked in. All in all, mechanical tree planting has really revolutionized man-made forests, shall we say, since the 1940s.
We now have many lumber companies themselves, or wood products companies, that have extensive reservations of forests in the state. Are these, do they use the mechanical planters too? And
principally the paper mills. Wouldn't there all the paper mills, if they have land in the state, have machines? And I will say that there are two groups who have been very, very helpful in expanding the use of machines on a loan basis, the paper mills and also the bankers. We have a Wisconsin Farmers Bankers Committee, I believe they call it, work with farmers. Quite a few banks have bought machines and turned them over to the Agricultural Extension Agent offices to assign to the farmers. The bankers aren't going to be worried about that. But the county agents and the district foresters have been assigned these machines to make available, so that it really has contributed a good deal. And of course, Trees for Tomorrow in northern Wisconsin, that association of paper mills, has bought several machines, and they do some custom planting. And in addition, since it is now widely accepted, many individuals have bought machines on their own and offer custom services.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, we have custom tree planting people that are skilled in it and make the machines available with their own services. They go along with the machines, furnish the power. You might say it's comparable, I suppose, to the old threshing rig where they went from farm to farm, and that's what these people do with their planting machines. There's one interesting thing that has been added to our machines. It shows where research has come in. We did not fully appreciate how much damage was being done to our plantations by these white grubs. They're, of course, the May beetles in the larva form. And where there are oak trees nearby, sometimes our plantations, year by year, would be losing 10 to 15% of their trees, of the planted trees. Even when they're 4 or 5 years old, they would die. And we knew something was wrong. Well, the entomology research people at the university, in cooperation with one of the paper mills, came up with a design of an automatic unit for shooting aldrin or other insecticides into the planting trench just as the tree went in. And after that, and in those places where grubs were a problem, we really had it licked. So today, Many of the pre-planting machines in the state have this supplementary equipment for the control of soil insects. Just simply saturate the planting zone for each tree automatically, and that's good for 4 or 5 years. By that time, the tree's able to take care of itself. So you see, there's been a constant improvement on these mechanical devices, as there are on practically all mechanical devices. Compare this old Ford downstairs in the museum with a Ford today.
Now, what would be the next topic that we should move on to?
Well, I think that there's an interesting story in the development of school forests in Wisconsin. There is another first for Wisconsin. Dean Russell, back in the 20s, had spent some time in Australia and New Zealand and had learned of a school forest movement among the public schools down under. He was quite impressed, and when he came back, he called into his office a man who many Wisconsin people knew well for many years, Mr. Wakelin McNeil, so well known as Ranger Mac. Mr. McNeil was assistant state club leader, and he was particularly interested in conservation work, so Dean Russell said, how about interesting some of our local school boards in setting up forests that are owned outright by the schools as outdoor laboratories. Mr. McNeil, who was always eager to use the out-of-doors as a laboratory, willingly gave his help to this idea. In fact, he organized it, and he appealed to some of the lumber companies up north to cooperate in making lands available. So the first three school forests anywhere in the country were set up in Forest County in April of 1928. Mr. Callahan, a very avid supporter of conservation teaching and a good friend of Ranger Max, attended the three demonstrations or dedications of those forests, the first of which was Leona in Forest County. It's interesting to note, incidentally, that the same principal, Mr. Robinson, attended that school for 30 years. Served as principal for 30 years, and was keenly interested in the development of the school forest over that 30-year period. In 1958, the 30th anniversary of the dedication of the Leona School Forest and the year in which Mr. Robinson retired, we had some special ceremonies marking the 30th anniversary. We had some men there who, at this 30th anniversary, who had been lads and helped plant the trees. One was a man who is now in the forestry work of the Conservation Department in a very responsible position, came over to the services and reported his impressions as a third or fourth grader when the trees were planted. Well, that idea really caught on. Today we have about 350 or 360 school forests in the state. They're increasing in number every year. I will say this, that there is a good deal more, caution and discretion used by school boards in accepting lands. Some of these lands that the lumber companies gave were not the best for a youngster to try to plant trees on. There have been some memorable gifts given by individuals who are interested in the school forest movement. And from some of those gifts, which were land well adapted to work by youngsters, we have had some marvelous school forests. I might mention, we have time here, one that I like to consider because there's a little history, a historical character involved. It's the school forest near Bancroft, between Bancroft and Plainfield.
That's what county is that?
That is in Portage County. Many trout fishermen in the state of Wisconsin, I'm sure, know about frost flies. Now, we're not advertising any particular trout flies, but there's a history back of the making of those trout flies by the Frost brothers. Their Aunt Carrie Frost, had taught them as little youngsters how to tie flies. And as they grew older, they went into the business. Carrie Frost was born and reared on a farm in southern Portage County, right along Highway 51. Later on, the farm was abandoned. The buildings were left standing, but the people moved to town. The land, however, was used for farming. The county agent felt that here was a wonderful opportunity for a school forest that might be named by Carrie Frost herself, because she was well up in years. And he had planned to suggest to her that she might give this 100 acres to the local school. Then suddenly she passed away, and the county agent felt that here had been a great opportunity missed. But a few weeks later, he went to the two nephews who had benefited by her teaching of tying flies, and suggested that since they were the heirs, that maybe they would like to give this to the local school as a memorial to their Aunt Carrie. Well, the county agent says that he was given a very cold reception and shortly was shown the door. And he felt quite depressed that he had not had the opportunity, didn't use the opportunity when he had it, to talk to Miss Frost personally. A couple weeks later, the nephews came to the county agent, Harry Noble, and said, you know, that was a rather rude reception we gave you, but we've done some thinking since then. And we have come to the conclusion that our Aunt Carrie would have agreed that there could be no finer memorial than to have the old farm taken over by the school youngsters and planted into a school forest. Well, just a few years ago, they planted the last of the trees on that 100 acres. It is a marvelous forest today. And teachers, as well as students, come to that forest to study the different ages of plantation. The trees are planted in strips, different years, parallel strips, so literally it's possible to walk from one end of that forest to the other and see how trees grow. See what they look like at 5 years of age, of 10 years of age, 15 years of age, when they begin to set cones, when they begin literally to form a forest soil. Most marvelous outdoor laboratory that could be imagined. And I'm sure those nephews are very proud today that this is named after their aunt. Well, now that's one of the examples, I could cite others, of how the school forest idea has caught on and has meant much to those who are in the instruction profession of providing laboratories for opportunity to do things as well as to study.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been any idea that these school forests might help someday to alleviate any of the financial problems that school districts have? In other words, trees will get old, and doesn't there come a time when a tree should be taken down in the forest?
Well, I should say that the management, including the cutting of these forests, is definitely in the picture. And you have asked a question that several school boards could answer in the affirmative. They have contributed materially at critical times. Now, here's just an example of how one worked. There's a school forest up in Oneida County. It belonged to a school district that was in the process of building a gymnasium with other facilities and part of instruction rooms. In other words, they're putting in a new building. But there was some special equipment they wanted for the gym. They found that they were $2,000 short. They had borrowed all they could. They had used all the money that was available. But to include what they wanted, it was going to take $2,000 more. Now, they had an 80-acre forest that, incidentally, had not been planted by man. It was one of those that they had gotten from the lumber companies. But after 30 years of intensive protection against forest fire, it had a marvelous second growth on it. So they turned to the school forest. They got volunteer labor from the men and the boys in the community. On weekends, they had some 10 or 15 power chainsaws buzzing away. I don't know how many tractors and teams in there. And in less than a month, they had delivered to the paper mill $2,000 worth of pulpwood. And so they achieved their ends. That's one example of where they have had income that was really very important. There's another angle I might mention just in passing, that some of these school forests are memorial forests to notable men in military service or otherwise in the state. Now, of course, we talked about Carrie Frost as a memorial to her. But we have, for instance, the Richard Bong Memorial Forest in Douglas County. which was dedicated a few years ago, just a couple years after the major had been killed. And one of the trees that was replanted by his family, who were present at this school forest, was a tree that he, as a 4-H club youngster, had planted on the home farm. And the community up around there, near Maple, are very conscious of the importance of school forests and are proud that they have identified their forest with the memorable history of Richard Baum.
Now we're going again here, and Mr. Trank is going to tell us something about the community. Was it the community forest that we're going to talk about now? What is this?
The community forests are really addition, you might say, to the concept of school forests. School forests are a community forest, but they're owned by school districts. Now there are other public units of government, governmental units, I suppose we should say, that are enabled by Wisconsin law to own and manage forests for themselves, or can appropriate money, can even borrow money. Towns, villages, cities, counties, as well as school districts, can go into the forestry business, literally. And some states don't allow local governmental units to do that, but Wisconsin does. Now, we have nearly 100 of those types of forests in the state, and some of them have shown some very profitable income. But there's one little story here that I might relate, because it shows how this school, this community forest law enabled Dunn County to solve a very baffling financial problem in reference to roads. Down in the Chippewa River, there was a large island that had about a dozen farmers on it. And there was one bridge from the mainland to the island. Well, as you know, the Chippewa River floods many, many times. In the course of a few years, several times even in 1 year. And after each of those floods, it was virtually a job of rebuilding the main bridge to the island, which was certainly expensive, and the county had to pay for it. So someone raised the idea, why doesn't the county just buy that island and move those people off and rip out the bridge and we're through with it for good? Well, then the question came up, and as I recall, it was presented to the district attorney, what authority has the county to buy that island? We're not going into farm business. What right have we to buy it? And as I say, I believe the story was that the district attorney said, well, here's the law that says a county can go into forestry business. And so they said, well, that's the answer. We will make that island a county forest. Now, there was good timing here. The land was bought up just before the war. The farmers, I think, in general, were willing enough to get off of the island. They knew that in a few of those floods, their very houses had been threatened. They sold the buildings, county sold the buildings after the farmers had moved, sold them at public auction, and as I say, during the war, lumber was pretty scarce. And some of those buildings bought much more than the county ever anticipated. But the point is that in the sale of those buildings and in the economy that was realized in the first 2 or 3 years after the county had taken out the bridge, the county had realized enough to liquidate the entire investment on buying the whole island. Now the question is, did the county keep faith with its premise that they were buying it for a forest? They certainly did. Most of the island, of course, had been farm and pasture, and it was ideally suited to machine planting. Here the machines had just come available, and so the county went in on a grand scale of planting trees. Now, interesting enough, getting the trees to the island with a bridge out was not the easiest thing. Getting the tractor to the island with the planting machine, the planting crews, They probably wished they had a bridge at that time. But by luck and good seamanship, they got the trees and the man and the machinery to the island. Today, that island, and I think it's something over 2,000 acres, I don't remember the exact acreage, is entirely planted up. I've been there once or twice since, and it is a marvelous place to see. There's a high water table, of course, on that island, so the trees, even though the soil is a bit sandy, always have enough water come sunshine and drought. And I don't think it's going to be so many years from now, but what Dunn County is going to realize, sustained income from its investment in forestry. So that really is a unique community forest. I might mention one other that gives Wisconsin something of a national record. The city of Superior owns a forest. There's a long story as to how the city got that from Douglas County, which we won't go into because it's a legal matter. But anyhow, it was a settlement of a claim by the city against the county, and the county gave almost 5,000 acres of county land to the city of Superior. Now, the record angle of it is this, that is the largest city forest in the United States that's entirely within the city limits. Now, there are other cities that have bigger city forests, like Seattle for its watershed, but that's miles and miles away and in another county. But the Superior City Forest is entirely within the city limits. And incidentally, of course, it has high recreational value, too, so that it's a, you might say, a dual-purpose forest there.
We were talking a few days ago, Mr. Trank, about the forest zoning up in our northern counties. Do I mean forest zoning?
Well, no. It's zoning for forestry and agriculture.
Zoning probably. For forestry and agriculture. And you were talking then about some of the problems that you men who went up there and actually had to convince the farmers and other settlers to the value of this particular legal situation. And you're telling me of some of the settlements from out of state that were up there. Could you go into any of these experiences that you had with some of the
Well, we can review that briefly. Zoning, the power of a county to prohibit certain uses on land, stems back to a law that was passed, I think, in 1927 or 29. Giving counties a power to zone for forestry, recreation, and agriculture, as well as for other urban purposes. In 1932-33, in the early days of the Depression, there was quite a movement from some of the major urban areas like Chicago and the Twin Cities and even Milwaukee to cheap land. Here was land up north, and there were still those land companies that were perfectly willing to profit by that that situation. Sure, they would sell land, and you know, when a person would see that he could buy 40 acres for $300, heavens above, that looked like a great bargain, and he was promised that he could grow enough on that land so that he could keep his family together in body and soul. And there were many who moved in under those circumstances. Well, of course, the local governments soon found themselves facing some real situations. Often this land was away from a road. It would mean that there would have to be a road built in. And invariably those families had children, and the state law says that the local government shall be responsible for education. There's no waiving that. And if there is any relief, the local government has to take that, and they soon found many of those cases were relief cases. So they began asking themselves, now just what are we in for? Is there any way that we can protect ourselves against settlement where it's going to cost us far more than we will ever get back from taxes? And that question was put to the Extension Service. We called attention to the law which authorized the counties to pass rural zoning ordinances that could actually prohibit settlement. Now, the thing that, as I recall, really triggered the whole event for the first county, which was Oneida County, happened in early 1932 when a young man, probably in his early 30s, came into the superintendent of schools. He had come from an urban area, I don't remember where, but he had moved on to a piece of land that was quite some ways from a road and a very long ways from a school. And he announced to the superintendent of schools, I have moved here, I'm a settler here now, and several things must happen. My wife happens to be a school teacher. Now you can hire her as the local school teacher to teach our youngsters in her home, or you can hire me to haul them to the nearest school and build a road for them. Well, you can imagine the reaction of the superintendent of schools. And he called his county land committee together and the district attorney and a few others, and they decided that maybe they had really better take a serious look at this zoning authorization. Now, we might say that from this extreme pressure, and there were others that bordered on it, the counties were really forced into passing ordinances. It took 3 or 4 years before all the educational and legal work was completed for those northern counties, but by 1936, 5 million acres had been zoned against year-round settlement. The principal alternate use was recreation and forestry, which did not involve year-round settlement. And of course, that has saved those counties untold quantities. Nobody knows how much money it saved them. And it's a good thing to have that on the books today. Now, there are over 4.5 million acres of public forests on those lands. You may say, well, it was going to be forestry anyhow. But when you get just a few scattered settlers back there, and some of them clearing land, they were also a fire hazard. And the counties and the forestry interests were willing to see that something was done not to have land clearing going on back in those forests, because land clearing generally meant burning brush.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, sure.
And a windy day.
Away it would go.
So sure. There was a whole chain of events that led up to this zoning work. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you say? Shall we call her quits?